The Nature Journal is brought to you by SAPI in the interest of conserving our planet and enriching and empowering all South Africans.
Well, with our citizen science program, and of course, this is the ADU section of the show, we talk about all sorts of different projects that they're involved in, and of course, often where citizen science is involved as well. Penguins are something that is of great interest to everybody. It's the happy feet syndrome. I'm not too sure. Personally, I have met the little characters and I have been bitten badly by them on more than one occasion. And strange enough, Richard, when I was a wee lad of about 14, my holiday job used to be to take the ski boat across from the University of Port Elizabeth out to St. Croix Island and back to the harbour. And more than once, we had a penguin that would latch onto somebody and hold them for about 11 nautical miles. And it's amazing, the people scream louder than the penguins. But I think let's find out more about penguin and penguin tracking. And we're chatting to Dr. Richard Shirley. And of course, we're going to refer to him as Richard for the rest of the program. We'll get over the doctor part. Now, Richard, penguin tracking. Really simple. I mean, after all, I track cheetahs. You walk along with a telemetry device and you walk behind the animal and you can find it quickly. It's in the middle of the Kalahari. How the hell do you find a penguin?
Oh, it's not so easy, actually. We're using satellite trackers and basically the device goes on the bird and the positions are relayed back to a satellite when the bird's on the surface and sit in our office comfortably and download them on a computer. And I was actually trying to find one recently that was standing on the beach and it's not so easy. Basically, the point behind this is that we don't know a lot about young African penguins do in the first few months and first few years at sea. Yeah, we've been tracking them over the last 3 years, trying to figure out answers.
Let's start with the tracking device itself. How would one describe the tracking device on a penguin?
I guess it's about the length of 2 5-rand coins, maybe about a sticker's 3 or 4 5-rand coins piled up. It's got a long antenna, small rectangular box basically with a long antenna, and it gets put on the back of the bird, which you stick it on with industrial strength super glue. It's very easy to stick your fingers to the bird with, and waterproof tape, effectively like gaffer tape.
Hold on, Mr. Penguin, we're just going to put glue on you and slap this device on and then let you go. How on earth do you get this thing off? I know what industrial strength super glue does if you stick your finger on it.
Yeah, we don't. We lose the devices. So because we're tracking juvenile birds, basically fledglings, on their first dispersal away from the island, we stick the device on and we don't expect to ever see the bird again. They spend maybe 2 years at sea before they return to molt for the first time into adult feathers. So we have to get the data back through the satellite, and the device falls off eventually. The glue goes brittle, tape falls off, and if the penguins really get upset with it, they can actually bite it. They can bite their feathers to remove it. So we only manage to keep them on for about 100 days at most at the moment.
You haven't found any of these devices in the stomachs of sharks?
No, the bird I was trying to find on the beach recently, it's transmitting from a beach at Jakobswaai, and there's a dead seal about 100 meters away from the final position of this bird. So I was thinking about cutting open the seal, but I don't think it'll transmit through the seal, actually.
When you say you're trying to find out what the birds are doing, why are you trying to find this out?
Well, I guess a lot of your listeners will know African penguins are endangered, and they've been declining quite dramatically, particularly in the Western Cape, since the mid-2000s. And we know quite a lot about what African penguins do during the breeding season, so they're quite easy to monitor at colonies. We have quite a lot of information on tracking the adults, where they forage. But it's really quite difficult to get information on what seabirds do when they're not at colonies, and particularly these young birds that spend many years away from breeding colonies. Immature birds can be quite a big proportion of the population, and they're quite important consumers, and they don't feed in the same areas as breeding adults. So we know that juvenile survival can be quite variable, and it's been quite low on the West Coast in the last few years, and we're trying to find out a little bit more about what drives these birds to move around between colonies, how that movement contributes to the overall changes in the numbers, and more importantly, the areas that these birds feed in when they first leave the island, and seeing if we can identify consistently important areas at sea. We talk about marine ecological hotspots, areas where these birds focus their activities.
Okay, hang on a minute. We're going to slap this on a penguin. How do you volunteer to become part of this program? Is it a case of you look the largest and fattest, we'll slick it on you, or is there any form of way where you turn around and say, I need to check that one?
Initially, we did a sort of pilot study using hand-reared chicks from Sankob. So you might know after the Treasure, quite a few chicks were hand-reared, and they released from Sankob in really good condition, and they seem to have survived at least as well as wild chicks and maybe even bred better in the future. And the chicks at Sankob have the benefit of being able to learn to swim a bit before they're released. So we can put the device on at Sankob and give them a chance to swim in the pool with the device, because it's a bit of an adjustment for the bird to have this thing on its back. Although it's not very big, it does add extra sort of drag when they're swimming. So we started out with that pilot study. We chose big, powerful birds in good body condition, using an index which was developed here at the ADU. And in 2012, we tracked three hand-reared chicks and three wild-reared chicks from Robben Island. So again, we selected big birds in good condition. And generally, the wild chicks did very well, as well as the hand-reared chicks that we tracked that year. And so this year we've been tracking wild chicks from all over the range, breeding range of the African penguin. And it, basically we have a cutoff of about 3 kilos in weight for fledging, which is a very good fledging mass. Quite big, because then they're more powerful. Generally they can cope with the extra drag and in good body condition.
You mentioned that these guys buzz off for 2 years. You stick the device on his back, you release him, and he just disappears out to sea. Where does he go to? Have you started to discover this yet?
Yeah, they move quite quickly away from the breeding colony. They have no post-fledging parental care, so they don't stay with adult birds. And they seem to sit on the currents, actually, and drift quite quickly away from the breeding colonies. And then there are a few spots that are coming out as important. Centinela Bay, and the area basically between Lamberts Bay and Hondeklip Bay on the west coast in particular. And that's an area of very high primary productivity, very high chlorophyll, and it's a small pelagic nursery ground, so a nursery for sardine anchovy, which are what we think the main things that penguins target. And then also we've had quite a few birds going up to Namibia from the west coast, going up to feed around Swakopmund, which is another area of high productivity. And we've tracked 10 birds from the Eastern Cape this year. Some of those birds have spent quite a lot of time feeding on the Agulhas Bank south of Cape Agulhas, and a few of them have now come around also onto the west coast. So they're moving large distances, and there are a few sort of hotspots, if you like, a few points that they're focusing on.
The ease of satellite now, does this simplify a lot of your research work? And is the information that comes to you, does it come to you on a regular basis?
Well, we sort of talk about remote tracking technologies, remote sensing technologies. These things are making really a big difference for seabird biologists. The sort of GPS devices getting smaller and lighter has made it much easier to track breeding birds. And now sort of immature birds, non-breeding adults, they're kind of the next frontier, if you like, trying to understand what those birds do. And the satellite devices are getting smaller again and lighter and cheaper. But the main thing is still, with this work, is still the cost, especially when we're losing the devices. With these particular devices, we're getting information back on a daily basis about where the birds are. It's a small number of fixes, maybe 3 or 4 positions a day. Nothing like the data that you can get now with GPS, but GPS, you have to recover it.
And given that amount of information that's coming, how long does this device last for example, if the glue didn't go brittle?
These have a battery life of about 180 days, the ones that we're using on every day. You can reduce the number of days it transmits for, and you can get much longer out of them. And people are tracking things like albatross, which navigate around the entire world. They're tracking those for a year or two. And there are developments going on in the UK, a group in Swansea working on a new type of harness made of silicon, which fits below the bird's feathers, which will make it easier to keep these sorts of devices on birds for much longer. We're not at the cutting edge, unfortunately, with this.
What does it cost to put a telemetry device on a penguin like this?
The device itself costs between 15 and 17,000 rand. It depends on the exchange rate at the time when we buy it. And then you have to pay for the satellite time, which, if the device runs for 100 days, can be another 6 or 7,000 rand again for each device.
So this is an expensive operation. It must be very difficult for you to raise funds for this, particularly when you go to somebody and say to them, terribly sorry, sir, could you please give me about 25,000 rand a bird? And by the way, we're going to lose it.
It's not easy, but we've actually done very well. I mean, Sankob have worked very hard, particularly on this project, raising funds, a lot of it coming from zoos and aquaria that hold African penguins here and also the US and in Europe. And the government have actually stumped up a lot of money for this. So the Department of Environmental Affairs have paid for a lot of these devices and for the Argus tracking time.
I suppose one of the questions here, Richard, once you've got all this information, where does it go? What is the goodness for the penguins from this information? Or is it a case of, all right, there's another postdoc document done?
We're very much hoping that it will feed into sort of spatial planning for fisheries management in South Africa, and particularly marine protected areas. So We're hoping to feed that information into spatial planning, which is going on at the moment in the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. We're feeding this tracking data at the moment into a bigger model that looks at how much fish is removed from the oceans around South Africa by different seabirds at different times of the year.
Hopefully it's not data, though, that turns around at the end of the day and somebody says, oh, hold on, these birds are taking out too much food, depriving man from food, time to cull them. And hopefully we don't get to that point, because I did see an article the other day where the minister has made a wonderful statement about seals that have taken too much fish away from the fisheries and the humans, so now it's time to cull the seals. And I thought, there goes another project. The information that you get, though, is it exciting, or is it a case of, oh no, not that again?
It's a little bit worrying, because the birds are going onto the West Coast and they're going up into Namibia. And it seems to be a pattern that's quite strong, repeatable. And I think they are, in a sense, hardwired. When they leave the colonies for the first time, they don't have a lot of information about what the environment's like. And they behave in a way that has made sense over millions of years. They travel to areas that should be very rich in the sardine anchovy that they want to feed on. But with Namibia being the perfect example, they have crashed their sardine stocks up there, and they're probably going up there and finding there's just pelagic goby. So they're not showing the flexibility that we would have hoped for. We were hoping that some of the birds from the West Coast would go around onto the Agulhas Bank and find food there, because that's where most of the sardine anchovy are now located. But they're sort of showing the behavior that we expected from ringing data in the 70s.
It's kind of hardwired. It's been done for millions of years, and nobody's saying, excuse me, take a left turn, chap, because that's where the food is. It's a case of traditionally the food is going to be in this direction. And I would imagine also a concern is that they're going further and further looking for the food. Interesting enough, The Conservationist and the Killers, written by Pringle. And you will discover that in 1654, the very first conservation law, for example, was passed in South Africa. And it was that no man should eat more than one half a penguin a day. And that is because of the concern of the dwindling penguin numbers. And that was because they were providing them to passing ships. Penguins, as we've heard, are always a bird that has been kind of abused over time. 13 million penguin eggs, they talk of having been removed over a 10-year period. Poor old penguins, because they're fat and tubby, and I know just how they feel, were even used to fuel boilers in time gone by. So not a great life if you're a penguin. You always think of happy feet. Maybe the feet aren't quite as happy as they should be. But of course, with the research work that people like Richard are doing, trying to unlock and discover more about the birds, can we redirect them to better food sources? And of course, can we protect the food sources that they do have or that they traditionally had? And if you do see a penguin with a little box on its back, no, it is not radio controlled. It is one of Richard's survey animals that are out sending back data. And hopefully he's getting the right message of buzzing off up the coast and doing what penguins do naturally. Richard, if people want to find out more about your work, is it in the ADU website?
Yeah, we have a webpage, penguins.adu.org.za, which contains updates on what's happening.
So if you want to find out more about it, penguins.adu.org.za, and that's where you'll find all the data. That is Dr. Richard Shirley, and of course, Richard looks after a penguin research project within the ADU, and of course, always an interesting program. And penguins, you can't do anything without people showing absolute interest about these comical little characters. But of course, comical little characters they may be, but they are animals in a form of distress. Richard, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
The Nature Journal is an initiative in support of the sustainability of our planet, its people, and prosperity. Brought to you by Sappi, global paper, packaging, and cellulose company. Sappi. Inspired by life.